This episode features discussion of kidnapping, alcoholism, domestic violence, and child abuse that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
Bobby Greenlease waited patiently in the back of the car. It had been a long drive, longer than usual anyway. He didn't understand why this strange woman had taken him from school. But Pope Pius said that, above all else, children should obey their elders.
Without either parent present, Bobby felt it was his duty to listen to whatever adults were in charge. And this woman and her husband in the front seat said they were Bobby's aunt and uncle, even though he had never met them before.
The man got out of the car, but stopped in front of Bobby's door. Bobby waited for him to open it, but he just stood there. Bobby turned to look at his aunt. She looked away quickly, opening her own door.
As he watched the woman walk mournfully into the woods, Bobby, perhaps for the first time in his life, began to worry.
He didn't know it, but just 30 minutes prior, Bobby Greenlease had been taken hostage.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive. I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy. You can listen to all of Parcast podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of Bobby Greenlease by Carl Hall and Bonnie Heddy, and the attempts by his parents and the FBI to get him home safely.
At about 10:55 a.m. on September 28, 1953, Bobby was taken from his school by a woman claiming to be his aunt. Within hours, the school realized its mistake and the Greenleases contacted the police. Soon after, they received a ransom note demanding $600,000 in exchange for Bobby's safe return.
This week, we'll look at the motivations of the kidnappers, the legacy of the Greenlease family, and the day of the kidnapping itself. Though not much is known of Carl Hall and Bonnie Heddy's early years, we'll attempt to understand their transition from troubled misfits to child abductors.
Next week, in part two, we'll learn of the bizarre negotiations process in which the kidnappers gave confusing instructions. We'll explore the FBI's investigation into the kidnapping and the media frenzy that resulted from the crime. In order to understand the motivations of Bobby Greenlease's kidnappers, Carl Hall and Bonnie Heddy, it's important to travel back in time and explore their formative years.
Born in 1919, Carl Austin Hall was the son of John Austin Hall and Zella C. Hall. Carl grew up in the small town of Pleasanton, Kansas, where his father was a well-known attorney.
In 1932, Carl Hall was a 13-year-old boy about to begin high school. This was the year of the infamous Lindbergh kidnapping, in which the infant son of the famed aviator was taken from his home and later killed.
Though one Bruno Richard Hauptmann would later be arrested for the crime, speculation persists to this day as to the true culprit.
It's a crime that young Carl Hall would have almost certainly been aware of, and that would perhaps remain in his subconscious for years to come.
John Hall, Carl's father, passed away that same year, leading to Carl's mother Zella enrolling him at the Kemper Military School in September 1933. Located in Boonville, Missouri, it was a regional fixture, training young men for service in the armed forces since the late 1800s.
Kemper also hosted problem students who had blown their chances at previous institutions. By 1933, Paul Greenlease was one such student. The adopted son of Robert C. Greenlease, the wealthiest auto dealer west of the Mississippi, He had rebelled throughout his youth.
Paul Greenlees and Carl Hall were at Kemper together for at least a year when Carl was 14 and Paul was 16. Neither could have predicted that in 20 years' time, Carl would kidnap Paul's younger half-brother, Bobby.
Carl Hall was by most accounts a strong student. He performed his duties with vigor and excelled in his coursework. It's hard to imagine that Carl didn't feel some resentment toward Paul Greenlees.
Carl didn't come from nothing. His father had been a successful and well-known lawyer in Pleasanton. But that was a small town, especially when compared to Kansas City, Missouri, where Paul grew up.
And while Carl's family was well off, Paul's family was endlessly wealthy. Paul's parents visited in a dark blue Cadillac. Carl's mother showed up in a Buick. Paul had Christmas at Union Station with all the cutest gals. Carl just went home to his mom.
And so Carl, the good student from a good family, paled in comparison to Paul, the problem student from the exceptional family.
Kemper students would sneak out whenever they could, finding a local bar or a good spot in the woods. It was normal to see who could drink the most. Some of the country boys would bring up some moonshine from their family homes in the Ozarks.
Some of the boys could drink this much and still excel in school. Carl Hall wasn't one of them. His mother, Zella, had never allowed any alcohol around the house, and it hit him like a deer kick to the face. But when he was drunk, he forgot about school, forgot about his strict parents at home, forgot about Paul Greenlees.
By 1936, 17-year-old Carl Hall got to where he needed a drink to get through the day. Just a few years ago, he had been a small-town boy who only drank alcohol when he could find it.
Carl's school record shows a history of positive and complimentary comments in 1933 and 1934. But by 1936, instructors began to refer to Carl in their reports as untrustworthy and rebellious.
In that same year, school records show that Carl Hall had taken ill and attempted to acquire alcohol while in the infirmary. Reading between the lines, it would seem that Carl had at the very least developed an alcohol problem, something school faculty were ill-equipped to diagnose and treat.
It's difficult to know the exact origin of Carl Hall's intense alcoholism. The final FBI file on the kidnapping makes no mention of any kind of psychiatric evaluation of the suspect, and genetic makeup is, of course, unavailable, considering the time frame of the crime and general obscurity of the culprit.
But it's clear that alcoholism dogged him for the rest of his life. In 1942, he was actually sentenced to time in the stockade at Quantico, Virginia, for being absent without leave. He was found to be sneaking away from the barracks and getting drunk.
Addiction expert and author William L. White notes in his History of Addiction Treatment in the United States that real research into the disease didn't begin until 1935. Any research gains in these years were unlikely to be of any use to Carl Hall at military school in Kansas, or later on the Pacific front of World War II.
Fundamental resources for alcoholics, such as Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't become widespread until the 1940s. Even if Carl had access to help, there is no evidence or record of him receiving any. He was on a downward spiral.
By 1944, 25-year-old Carl Hall was fighting on the beaches of the Solomon Islands, Peleliu, and eventually Okinawa. These battles were among the bloodiest of a war that was already the deadliest in history.
It was hardly an environment conducive to recovering from a drinking problem, and indeed, Carl was frequently punished for disappearing on drinking binges. Despite this, he was kept on until the war's end in 1946. Perhaps the Marines needed every body they could get, even an alcoholic one, or perhaps they were sympathetic to Carl, given the horrors he was witnessing in battle.
But of course, Carl had likely already been an alcoholic for years before the war. Again, it's difficult to pinpoint the exact root of his illness, But the next chapters in his life reveal him to be long-suffering.
By September 1951, in Kansas City, Missouri, Carl was penniless. Now 32 years old, he had seen combat in World War II, ran a few businesses into the ground, had a failed marriage that resulted in no children, and lost both his parents. In the 5 years since leaving the Marines, he gambled and drank away the money his parents left him.
One night, under the influence, he walked along the river. As he passed the Western Auto Building, its giant glowing sign made him think of Paul Greenlease and his father's Cadillac empire.
The light swelled in Carl's vision. In addition to his alcohol addiction, Carl had also recently developed a morphine habit. The drug made everything slower, more significant somehow. Carl felt that perhaps this light shining down on him was a figurative sign, in addition to being a literal one.
A taxi pulled up to the curb, dropping off a wealthy couple.
Some strange compulsion led Carl to reach in his pocket, where his hand gripped his Smith & Wesson revolver.
He stalked, not towards the wealthy couple, but the cab, tapping on the driver's side window.
The man just motioned for him to get in the back. Awkward, Carl just knocked on the glass again. The cabbie finally rolled down the window. That's when Carl lifted the gun.
The cabbie actually scoffed. Carl wanted his cash? Okay. He reached down, emptying the box on the dashboard and revealing that it contained less than $2.
Embarrassed, Carl just swiped the money.
Carl actually thought that maybe his boldness would pay off, so he went after another cab. It had a similarly low amount in the till.
He never made it to a third.
The police were called, and it didn't take them long to find Carl, seated on a bar stool, already having spent the stolen cash.
His cab-robbing spree perhaps foreshadowed his lack of discipline. Why risk so much for so little gain?
Carl was sentenced to the Missouri State Penitentiary, serving from September 1951 to April 1953. Carl spent long hours with his cellmate, a check forger, discussing the perfect financial crime. How could an individual make the most money in the shortest amount of time and get away without being identified by the cops?
In September 1952, while Carl Hall lay daydreaming in his cell about the perfect crime, Bonnie Emily Hetty of St. Joseph, Missouri, was finally divorcing her abusive husband.
Her husband, Vernon Ellis Hetty, was a livestock salesman. They had lived well for 20 years, participating in square dances and dog shows. But Vernon's dislike of children led him to force Bonnie into 11 abortions over the course of their marriage.
These were illegal at the time, and even more dangerous and potentially psychologically damaging for Bonnie.
As the years progressed, friends and acquaintances of Bonnie's began to notice she was frequently intoxicated, even showing up drunk to some of the aforementioned dog shows.
It would seem that she had begun to cope with life's hardships by turning to alcohol. Soon, she, like Hall, couldn't make it an hour without a drink. It said she drank as much as a fifth of whiskey a day.
Fairly quickly after the divorce in September 1952, friends of Bonnie Hetty began to notice strange music coming from her home. Men called at all hours, and it became clear that she had turned to sex work to support herself.
And while sex work in and of itself is not indicative of any kind of illness or malfeasance, most of Bonnie's profits were going toward fueling her alcohol addiction.
And this is perhaps the best indication of how serious her alcohol abuse had become. Not only was she dependent on the substance, but she now had to mold her life around the pursuit of it. She had long since crossed the threshold from drinking problem to full-blown alcoholic.
The National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, known as NIAAA, reports that there are 5 types of alcoholics. Both Bonnie and Carl fit into the rarest and most dangerous category, chronic severe.
People in this subtype begin drinking at a young age, though they may not become truly addicted until middle age. They have a high rate of divorce and in all likelihood use other drugs beyond alcohol.
We know for certain that Carl began drinking at Kemper Military School. Bonnie and Carl were both coming off of bad marriages, and Carl at least was also known to have a drug habit.
Another characteristic of this subtype is that the alcoholic also potentially suffers from depression, bipolar disorder, or other personality disorders.
And in some cases, they are more prone to acts of criminality. While we don't know for certain that either Bonnie Hetty or Carl Hall suffered from mental illness, they were absolutely both drawn to a life of crime. Their nefarious partnership began almost as soon as they met.
Bonnie regularly picked up sex work clients at the Pony Express Bar in the Rubidoux Hotel in St. Joseph.
One night in April 1953, Bonnie met a potential client who, for a change, was charming and kind. Almost immediately, she fell for him.
He introduced himself as Carl Hall of Kansas City, Missouri. He was recently paroled from jail, having served time for insurance fraud, he claimed. He thought she was beautiful.
Of course, whether he was actually attracted to Bonnie or not, Carl had seen potential in Bonnie, potential for manipulation.
They moved in together almost immediately after meeting in April 1953. And by June 1953, Carl began to speak about the Greenlease family, how wealthy they were, their fleet of Cadillacs, how they had their names on various Catholic institutions throughout the city.
When Bonnie was halfway sober, she would try to steer the conversation towards something more normal. Who cared about some rich family? It wasn't until he began to drive them by the Greenlease estate in Mission Hills that she started to worry.
But she ignored her doubts. Carl loved her, and he put up with her addiction. They were two societal misfits living in a world skewed by constant intoxication.
What Bonnie didn't know was that Carl had been planning to abduct one of the young Greenlease children for some time. He remembered Paul Greenlease from Kemper Military School, and when he read in prison that Paul's father, Robert, now had two young children from a second marriage, Carl's perfect crime suddenly came into focus.
And he would use the lonely and pliable Bonnie Hetty to help him pull it off. In just 6 months' time, the two lovers would commit one of the highest-profile kidnappings in the history of the United States.
Up next, we'll look at the Greenlease family and the planning of the kidnapping.
Now back to the story.
1950s Kansas City was in many ways the quintessential American city, embodying the 50s virtues of hard work, faith, and family. And no family embodied those virtues more than the Greenlease clan.
Robert C. Greenlease, the family patriarch, came from a Missouri farming family. Born in 1882, he was not a well-known name in town at the beginning of his life. But by 1918, he had built his own Cadillac dealership in downtown Kansas City.
The business found huge success, and Robert grew it over the years to include dealerships throughout the Midwest. He eventually became a major investor in General Motors, and by the 1950s was estimated to be worth $24 million. Accounting for inflation, that would be roughly $250 million in modern currency.
His wealth was legendary, even outside of Kansas City.
And in the naivete of an innocent town in a more innocent time, the Greenlease family never considered the degree to which their wealth might make them a target for criminals.
Robert and his first wife, Betty, had no biological children, but they adopted Paul Greenlease, who was born in 1917. Robert's marriage to Betty ended in divorce, And in 1939, Robert married again, this time to Virginia Pollock Greenlease.
Their first child, Virginia Sue, was born in 1941. 6 years later, in 1947, Bobby Greenlease was born. He was raised in total luxury. The family had servants, went on European vacations, and gave Bobby anything he wanted.
This included a pet parrot, two dogs, and his own mini Cadillac to drive around the block. It was an upbringing that led Bobby to never question the world and gave him no reason not to trust the people in it.
By 1953, it had never crossed the family's mind that the sweet six-year-old boy who played in the yard with his dogs and said all of his prayers every day could ever be in danger.
Bobby had been playing in the backyard by the stream all afternoon, having gotten home from school early. He liked to lift up the large white slabs of stone on the riverbank and look at the insects underneath.
He really wanted to take off his shoes and wade in the stream. He knew there were some small fish and maybe crawdads, but Mama wouldn't be happy, and Bobby knew God was watching.
Bobby jumped up from the riverbank. He looked over toward the house, where a birch tree was shedding bark and feathers.
Skipping over the riverbank and toward the house, he found what had happened at the foot of the tree.
A bird had flown into the tree, falling into the grass below. Its head was turned at an odd angle, and it called out sadly, repeatedly. Finally, it stopped moving. Its eyes glazed over. It was dead.
Bobby's stomach turned, but his heart hurt too. His eyes welled up. He quickly got to his knees, clasped his hands, and began to pray.
Lord, let me not seek as much to be consoled as to console, for it is in giving that one receives. It is in pardoning that one is pardoned, and it is in dying that one is raised to eternal life.
Bobby opened his eyes, wincing as he looked up at the overcast but bright sky. His father appeared above him, frowning.
Robert leaned down next to Bobby, about to place his hand on the six-year-old's shoulder. He pulled back at the last moment, apparently unsure of himself.
But Bobby wasn't, and he threw himself at his father, hugging him. Robert relented, returning the hug.
The Greenleases were a close-knit family, and as mentioned previously, they were devout Catholics.
Indeed. Even today, their name still adorns various Catholic institutions throughout Kansas City, such as the Greenlease Library at Rockhurst University.
This belief system largely informed the family's worldview. The Pope was Christ's representative on earth. The priests who served in the church carry out his, and therefore God's, will.
And for Bobby, the nuns at his school, Notre Dame de Sion, were also representatives of the Lord and thus commanded his obedience.
This was 1953, before the Second Vatican Council of 1962 that forbade corporal punishment in Catholic schools.
So not only did Bobby fear the nuns on religious grounds, he also knew they might just pose a physical threat if he misbehaved.
All of this helps to explain why Bobby went along with what came next. On the morning of September 28, 1953, Robert drove Bobby to school in his pale blue Cadillac. The six-year-old sat quietly and respectfully as always, his feet dangling off the leather cushion, his hands clasped in his lap.
The car came to a stop in front of the school. Robert leaned over, helping Bobby collect his bag and his coat. A nun opened the door, greeting them.
Bobby hopped out, slung his leather backpack over his shoulder. "Goodbye, Dad," he waved.
Robert smiled and nodded. The nun closed the door and waved as well. She took the boy's hand and led him inside. Robert allowed himself a few moments to watch.
He was proud of his son. He was a little softer, maybe, than Robert had been growing up on the farm or his other son Paul had been as a little boy. But his heart and his enthusiasm for the world was infectious.
Robert forced himself to drive on. He had a full day ahead, as always. The dealership didn't run itself.
Bobby had a normal morning. He dutifully prayed in chapel, paid attention in class. He was getting better at reading. In between lessons, he showed off his Jerusalem medal to the other students. He liked telling them about how it was supposed to remind them about the Holy Land.
But then, late in the morning, something not so normal happened. Sister Moran arrived in class, interrupting. She said Bobby's aunt had come to see him. He didn't know he had an aunt, but he followed.
It was an innocent mistake, but one that would cost Bobby and his family dearly.
Up next, we'll examine just how Carl Hall and Bonnie Hetty plotted and executed the kidnapping. Now, back to the story. In the early weeks of September 1953, Bonnie Hetty found her life engulfed in preparation for the kidnapping. At practically every meal, Carl lectured her about the plan, making her repeat her role in it out loud.
She wanted to please him. She thought they could just get through this, and then he'd be the man he'd been the night they first met. She even tried to show enthusiasm, helping him with the wording on the first ransom note. He wanted to sign it M, not for any particular reason, but because he thought it sounded suitably mysterious. Funny how he could be so meticulous about some details and so cavalier with others.
In fact, he had become downright obsessive about the crime. Some days, Bonnie hardly recognized him. He practically oozed with greed when he discussed Robert C. Greenlease's money. It was as if Greenlease had wronged him somehow, as if Carl thought the money was rightfully his.
Bonnie's alcohol consumption had increased to 2/5 of whiskey a day, and she knew Carl was barely any better. They were both planning this crime through the prism of constant inebriation.
In fact, it's this state of drunkenness that might explain how two previously small-time criminals might have been capable and motivated enough to commit such a significant crime.
According to a 2010 study at the University of Kentucky, alcohol leads to an increase in human intentionality bias, which refers to the human tendency to view the actions of others as deliberate.
In other words, we forget to consider the internal lives of others and just assume their actions are purposely aimed at us. If someone cuts us off in traffic, we think it's because they are deliberately trying to be rude, rather than considering the more likely explanation that they just weren't paying attention.
In bars, where many are feeling the influence of alcohol, this effect can have dramatic consequences. One drunk individual might knock over a drink of another accidentally, but because the second drunk individual can't put aside their intentionality bias, they assume this was a deliberate act. They start a brawl, overreacting to the extreme.
For Carl, this may have manifested in the form of his obsession with the Greenleases. While Paul Greenlease was completely unaware of Carl during their time at school together, and likely meant him no ill will, Carl may have seen him as a privileged adversary.
Or he may have seen the disparity between his loss of wealth and the Greenleases' continued success, and in his drunken mind imagined that the world was conspiring against him.
Now imagine Bonnie Hetty and Carl Hall, both always under the influence. Their perception of the world warped. They would have fueled one another, neither with a clear enough head to point out the insanity of what they were planning.
Couple this outlook with the potential influence of drugs or mental illness, and it becomes clear as to how the pair could go from planning a kidnapping to planning something much worse.
At first, Bonnie went along with Carl's preparations for the kidnapping. They traveled to Kansas City, to Union Station, where they picked up a copy of the Oklahoman, cutting a Greenlease ad from it and applying it to the ransom note envelope. Carl hoped this would make investigators think they were from Oklahoma.
Carl rented a green Ford and began to drive by the Greenlease home, as well as follow Robert Greenlease as he took Bobby to school.
While the Greenleases were on vacation, they repeatedly called the housemaid, posing as school officials and asking for details on Bobby.
On or about September 14, 1953, Bonnie sat with Carl at her breakfast table, downing a whiskey. Carl was making her go over the plan again. She squinted her eyes, her eardrums pounding.
It was more than she could take. She decided to scratch the itch that had been bothering her since the beginning of all of this, to ask about the elephant in the room.
Bonnie interrupted Carl from his usual ramblings. She asked him what they were going to do with Bobby once they had him. Tie him up in the basement? Keep him out on the farm somewhere? He couldn't just roam around the house while they waited for the ransom to be paid.
He rubbed the back of his neck, looking away, ashamed. There was something he wasn't telling her.
He never gave a clear answer.
The pounding in her ears grew louder. She reached back out for her drink, finishing it in one gulp.
She thought again of the man she had first met and how charming he was, and how he made her feel cared for like her husband never had. And she thought for the thousandth time, if she just indulged Carl this once, she would never hear the name Greenlease again. It was the morning of September 28, 1953. Bonnie Hetty and Carl Hall got up earlier than usual, 6 a.m. Bonnie's hand immediately went for a bottle of whiskey, but Carl appeared suddenly, stopping her. He shook his head and took the bottle.
The previous 24 hours came crashing back down onto her. She remembered what they had to do today.
Each action took on a different tone than normal. Washing her face, applying her makeup, putting on her earrings. It all seemed so ominous, a weird ceremony in preparation for a sacrifice.
It was about 10 a.m. They sat together in the front seat of Bonnie's station wagon in silence. Bonnie began to sweat. Her hand trembled. She didn't normally make it this far into the morning without a drink.
Carl eyed her with annoyance. He reached out to stop her hand. Then a concession. They would stop for one drink.
Even though she was completely sober, Bonnie later told police that she had no memory of the bar they stopped at. She just waited while Carl ordered her a drink, and she downed it as if it contained life-saving juices. Carl, downing a whiskey of his own, threw some cash on the bar and grabbed her by the arm, dragging her back out the door. Before long, they were back in the car.
After a time, they arrived at their destination and Carl pulled over. The whiskey must have been a double because it hit Bonnie hard. She stumbled out of the station wagon and into the parking lot of Cat's drugstore. Carl saw Bonnie stumble and came up from behind, steadying her. He swore and moved past her into the store.
Carl returned with some nausea medication and breath mints. He was always thinking of her. She was reminded of why they had started this relationship those few months ago.
But no sooner had she downed the items than he was grabbing her by the shoulders, looking her in the eye, and reminding her of the first step.
She gave one last sideways glance to the pavement, then turned from Carl, pounding the pavement toward the taxi service down the street.
As Bonnie pulled up to Notre Dame de Sion School in the cab, the Virgin Mary herself sat above the doorway of the school, quietly judging.
Bonnie brushed off the look from the statue. Mary wasn't there when her husband had abused her. She wasn't there at the bottom of endless liquor bottles. Bonnie owed her nothing.
All she had was Carl. All that mattered was Carl.
It was 10:55 a.m., Bonnie ordered the cab to wait, moving to the front door. A nun, Sister Moran, answered. She looked young and naive.
Bonnie put on her best, panicked face. "I'm here for Bobby Greenlease," she said. "I'm his aunt. His mother collapsed this morning. I need to take him to see her in the hospital."
Sister Moran looked at her, confused. Bonnie knew that many of the nuns at the school came from France. Perhaps there was a language barrier. That was all Bonnie needed.
Though she didn't know it, Bonnie had in fact lucked out in this encounter. The Mother Superior, Irene, was away. The next nun in the hierarchy, Mother Marthana, was busy teaching a class.
Bonnie thus encountered a young Sister Moran, left in charge of visitors. Moran had only recently joined the order and so was unsure of procedure. And she was indeed French, fluent in English, but with a strong accent.
Bonnie feigned confidence, like Carl had told her to. "It's rather urgent. She's not well." She gestured at the nun to hurry.
The other woman finally relented, ushering her inside.
Inside, all was quiet as Bonnie waited in the foyer. Sister Moran disappeared down the hallway.
Across the room, a slightly older nun watched with concern. Bonnie smiled and nodded at her. "Is Mrs. Greenlease at St. Mary's?" the nun asked. The woman also had a French accent, and so Bonnie missed what she was saying. "The hospital, St. Mary's. Is your sister staying there?" the nun tried again.
"Oh yes, of course," replied Bonnie. Bonnie cursed herself inside. The nun was now asking if she wanted to call and check on her sister while she waited. The sisters knew some of the doctors there. "No, no," Bonnie said. She and Bobby would see for themselves soon enough.
But the nun seemed determined to make herself useful, and so then she asked Bonnie if she wanted to step into the chapel for a moment and pray together for Mrs. Greenlease. It would take another few minutes to get Bobby checked out of class.
Bonnie sat there, beginning to sweat. She'd already engaged this woman too much, as Carl had warned her not to. The nun was complicating the whole thing.
She knew Carl would want her to just say no, but how could she tell a nun she didn't want to pray? Wouldn't that look suspicious? Did she not already seem suspicious standing here right now, her answers curt and slow to come?
"All right," she finally muttered.
The nun led her to an empty pew in the chapel. Jesus looked down on them both from the cross, while candles flickered below him, their light carrying prayers up to God.
Bonnie was unsure if she was meant to say the prayer or if the nun would begin. Luckily, after a beat, the sister led them both in asking God for Mrs. Greenlease's safe recovery.
"Almighty and eternal God, you are the everlasting health of those who believe in you. Hear us for your sick servant Virginia, for whom we implore the aid of your tender mercy. Through Christ our Lord. Amen." The nun finished her prayer.
Bonnie said nothing. She contemplated the irony of praying for Virginia Greenlease. She was about to ruin the woman's life.
Both Bonnie and the nun turned to see the sister who had originally answered the door had returned, and at her side, Bobby.
Bonnie had seen him at a distance before and in pictures, but never up close. He had such a wide smile. She never remembered being that happy as a little girl in school. When the nun next to him told him his aunt was here to take him to see his mother, he didn't object. He simply walked forward, and he took Bonnie's hand. She almost recoiled at the touch.
They exited the building, walking across the front drive and getting into the cab. She asked him about his dogs. Excitable, he ignored this and instead answered that he now had a parrot who ate crackers and could talk, but never once did he question who she was. The whole thing lasted only a few minutes. It was just past 11.
Back at the drugstore, Carl was still waiting in the station wagon. His face practically lit up at the sight of Bobby. Bonnie felt a rush, knowing she had pleased her man. It was almost over.
They drove silently on the road west into the Kansas countryside.
Eventually, buildings gave way to trees, and before long, they arrived at the end of a long road behind a farm. Carl pulled the car over, stopping the ignition. He looked at Bonnie.
The look almost crumpled Bonnie right then and there. Images of the boy playing in his yard, being driven to school by his father, him telling her about his bird just a few minutes earlier. They all flashed through her head, She looked in the rear view and saw his little face as it gazed with curiosity out the window.
She rushed from the car, taking several steps towards a nearby pasture. She found a fence post and gripped it, as if bracing herself for a wave or a gust of wind. Her ears pounded. She had to pee. She needed a drink.
In her head, she continued to repeat that it would all be over soon. It would all be over soon.
Of course, it had only just begun.
Next week on Hostage, we'll follow the ransom process between Carl Hall, Bonnie Heady, and the Greenlease family. The plot thickens as the criminal couple attempt to make their escape and the FBI gets involved.
Bonnie and Carl are forced to take responsibility for their actions. The Greenleases must cope with Bobby's abduction. And law enforcement cracks the biggest kidnapping case in United States history, only to mysteriously lose half of the ransom money.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Greg Castro and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.